This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear from the CEO of Rivian Automotive, who says their first vehicle will be more like a Patagonia jacket than a Hugo Boss suit.
This needs to be something that you enjoy. Provides a great, is a great product, but at the same time, you can use it. You can get dirty. You can go places. You can put your things in it.
RJ Scaringe talks about the company's first two self-driving electric adventure vehicles, a 5-passenger pickup and a 7-passenger SUV. And it's a conversation with the filmmaker behind the documentary, The Colorado, screening at Illinois Wesleyan tomorrow. The unconventional film is a marriage of stunning visuals and music commissioned especially for the film. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 5th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Rivian Automotive was recently certified by the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council as having met requirements for ongoing tax breaks, and taxing bodies are in the process of approving continuing tax abatements. The certification means the electric auto manufacturer located at the former Mitsubishi plant invested $500,000. Year two requirements mean a $10 million investment into the plant and the hiring of at least 35 people. Rivian has announced plans to release an SUV and a truck in 2020. They have also released the names of their management team. But beyond that, the electric automaker still has the vibe that has people asking, what's going on behind the curtain? Rivian Automotive CEO RJ Scaringe traveled through Normal late last week and stopped by the GLT studios. He says the plant is being readied for vehicle assembly and the vehicles are being tested.
Development's progressing very nicely. The team has grown quite a bit in terms of our development organization. A lot of work on our battery system and a lot of our connected systems, all the technology to connect the vehicle so we can monitor its health, monitor its state of charge. All of this has been built and is currently testing as we speak.
And not all of that is happening in Bloomington Normal. You have facilities across the country.
So we have three development facilities. We have a development facility in Michigan where we house a lot of our vehicle-related pieces. So think chassis, body, interior, vehicle packaging, vehicle design. Then on the West Coast, we have two development locations, one in San Jose in the Bay Area. And there we house our connected car and cloud activities, as well as our self-driving activities. And then in Southern California, in Irvine, we have all of our battery development activities.
Let's listen to part of a promotional video that Rivian tweeted out on January 7th.
We are a passionate team developing intelligent vehicles for life's adventures, large or small. In 2020, Rivian will introduce two premium electric adventure vehicles on the same all-wheel drive platform. A 5-passenger pickup, followed by a 7-passenger SUV. Soon after, we will launch new options for how you drive, own, and maintain your vehicle, and transform how you experience and explore the world. Fully connected, highly refined, incredibly capable. Rivian.
And that's audio from a Rivian promotional video. What is an electric adventure vehicle?
So when you start to think about really the future of mobility and what's going to happen to the world's miles and how we consume those miles, what we believe will occur is those miles will start to split into different vehicle segments where, as a consumer, you'll have the option to pick very commoditized options, things that simply take you from A to B. And you'll also have, you know, choices that are more aspirational or desirable, and they'll take you, let's say, on your daily commute, on your trip to the lake with the family, trip skiing, your trip to the beach. And as a brand, we're developing products that really can take you, your family, your loved ones to the places you love, whether that's the lakeside, whether that's grandma's house, whether that's the side of a mountain. Or whether it's the more everyday adventure, the trip to IKEA. So these are vehicles that are designed and the services to support those and the customer models around those to really embrace life's adventures.
Sure. From your website, it says
to get you to the mountain and back on a single charge, that safely cross streams with your whole family, that carry enough gear for any trip and let you enjoy the wilderness in silence. What's happening in Normal and Michigan to deliver on that point? It sounds like a tall order.
Yeah, so here in Normal, we've got a huge amount of work happening at the plant. From looking at the outside in from the street, to the outside of the facility hasn't changed, but on the inside, we're in the process of getting the facility set up to build our vehicles and build our platform. So what that entails right now is a lot of work going through, looking at the various aspects of the facility, understanding how that fits into our production plan and into our production process, and starting to make some of those changes. So we're reworking the body shop portion of the plant, we're reworking the assembly portion of the plant, and really over the course of the next year, that'll start to come together in terms of a lot of those changes.
And how many people about are employed at the former Mitsubishi plant, current Rivian production facility?
Sure. So end of 2017, we had about 35 people. We're now up to about 40 people at the plant. And at this point, obviously not producing vehicles, but getting the plant ready. So and then more broadly than that, outside of here in Normal, we have a total of close to 300 employees now. And we continue to grow.
Here's what you had to say to GLT in late 2016 about the vehicles we might see soon.
There's a portfolio of related vehicles that come out again, as I said, we'll be launching the production in 19 and sales will be going in early 2020. It is a large format vehicle, so it's not a small vehicle. This is something that's designed to really enable active lifestyles. So if you're into hiking, you're into biking, if you're a Home Depot weekend warrior, this is a really ideal vehicle for you.
Home Depot instead of IKEA. This in 2016 was the example that you used. That's RJ Scaringe from a 2016 Sound Ideas interview. I'm Mike McCurdy with the Rivian CEO. I think people are really eager to see these vehicles. When will they see a photo? When will they be able to touch one or set in a Rivian vehicle or maybe test drive one?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we're as we come into 2020 with our commercial launch and these vehicles being available and these services being available for consumption. We'll be starting to show a lot more. And later this year, we'll be revealing some of the details around the way the vehicle looks, the performance specifications. You'll get to see these vehicles driving, but that's going to be very late this year. Of course, at this point, we've got prototypes and various types of development properties being tested, looking at all the major systems. So obviously, the battery system needs to be really well-developed and refined. All the connectivity platforms embedded on the vehicle, the self-driving aspects of the vehicle are being tested across these different development locations we have between Michigan and our two California locations.
Will self-driving capabilities be part of the initial vehicle launch, or will that be something that comes later?
Oh, certainly. So think of, you spend a day at the lake or a day at the beach with the family. You hop back in the car. You want to talk to your family. You want to check your phone. The ability to take your hands off the wheel, eyes off the road, we think is an important brand-defining experience. And then over time, those self-driving capabilities will expand and grow. And as those self-driving capabilities expand and grow and take the vehicle into a domain where it can operate without anyone in the vehicle, it really allows us to shift how you think about consuming that vehicle. So it moves from something that you may personally own to something that you may subscribe to, something you may fractionally own, something that you use just as a service. Think of it as, your adventure for the weekend, we can pick you up. So these are what we're building into our technology roadmap and the vehicle platforms designed for all those activities.
So in 2021, I might be able to buy a Rivian vehicle that will drive me. I won't drive it.
Yeah. And for that matter, shortly thereafter, as we start to think about how you would consume a Rivian, at launch in 2020, you'd be buying the Rivian. Very soon, we'd want to offer you options where you can consume it in other ways.
So
you
can subscribe to it.
It can provide you a service. You can fractionally own it. So there's a whole host of new consumption models that we're building into our business model.
I'm interested in the modular nature of the truck and its adaptability, which we reported on in January, and wonder if the SUV will have those similar modular capabilities.
One of the things we spend a lot of time thinking about as a company is designing a vehicle and a set of services around that vehicle that are very aspirational, something that you really enjoy, something that feels special, but at the same time doesn't make you uncomfortable using it. And the analogy we often think of is if you look at two nice pieces of clothing, let's say one's a Hugo Boss suit and the other's a Patagonia jacket, we really want to orient ourselves towards that Patagonia jacket in the sense that this needs to be something that you enjoy. You provides a great is a great product, but at the same time, you can use it. You can get dirty. You can go places. You can put your things in it. So what we would call as being very invitational for life's adventures is something we're embedding into it. So as part of that, different degrees of modularity throughout the vehicle become very important.
Rivian tweeted out a photo from Corona, California on February 8th about some field research. It looks like, it looked like a photograph taken from behind the windshield of one of your vehicles. What was going on there?
So we have a...
testing the batteries remote stretches?
So that's actually not far from our Irvine location, very close to our Irvine location. So we have a lot of testing activity happening out there, and that was one of our testing teams from a benchmark vehicle.
Can you talk a little bit about the strategy of releasing a truck first and going after that that active lifestyle market? That's something that you don't see other electric auto manufacturers doing.
Sure. So if you zoom out and you start to think about mobility, and I talked about this a little bit a moment ago, and perhaps the best way to start this discussion or to start thinking about this is to think of it in terms of miles. And on our planet today, on a per year basis, we drive about 10 trillion miles, which is a staggering number. And to deliver those 10 trillion miles, we need roughly 1 billion cars. And what we see happening, not like a light switch, but on a continuum over the coming decades, is those miles beginning to bifurcate into things that are purely commoditized. Think of it as sort of a pod to take you from point A to point B. And these are really service to short duration unplanned trips. And then things that are more aspirational, things that deliver something that's branded, something that's desirable. And this is your daily commute. It's regular, repeatable. This is your trip from Chicago to Detroit, from New York to Boston. And it's within that aspirational domain that our brand is focused. We're developing technologies, of course, that span the whole spectrum. But within that, as we think about that experience, we want to create something that, from an aspirational point of view, really can define the idea of exploring, the idea of going and seeing new things. And when you look at the segments to do that with, the pickup space is, when you hear that, it's a very ripe space. It's a space for which inherently it has some advantages for carrying life's gear, your family, your belongings, your things. But it's compromised in that these are vehicles today that are not very efficient. They're not particularly fun to drive. They don't have lockable storage in terms of trunk space. So as a brand, this first product, we see an opportunity to really rethink and reimagine a space. And there's features and characteristics on that launch vehicle which really help connect us with the idea of exploring and going places and adventure. And that brand promise has to transcend all the changes we're going to see over the next 20, 30, 40 years. So the shift away from steering wheels, the shift away from traditional ownership. And so the first product is really our handshake with the world to say, we're a brand that's here to help you engage with life's adventures. And as we move into mobility models where you don't have to own the asset, that brand becomes really powerful because then someone that may not own a Rivian can still use it for your adventure, still use it for your commute, still use it to take the family out to lunch.
Obviously much more than a marketing decision to go after that segment of the market, though.
Yeah.
Obviously, based on your description. At this point, the vehicle is being marketed as an adventure vehicle. What about support? Being in the middle of nowhere with mechanical or battery issues might present some anxiety for a potential buyer. Is there some sort of support mechanism that you're thinking about? Maybe mechanism isn't the right word. Support infrastructure or people behind the scenes
Understood.
That could help.
So first, just as a comment, these are vehicles that have a large battery pack. So they do have significant levels of range. So they're able to, as we said, they can get you on your adventure and back on a single charge. But with that, they're also embedded in them a deep digital architecture that connects with the cloud. And for us, the way we developed the vehicles, we really started with the cloud first, and we created essentially a mirrored data layer where everything that's happening on the vehicle is also mirrored into the cloud. And it allows us to provide think of it as a safety net, so that as the vehicles are out, if there's any issue on the vehicle, we can provide support. This becomes increasingly important as you move away from a world of ownership and towards a world of various forms of subscription or sharing or multi-user utilization.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Rivian Automotive CEO RJ Scaringe. Ford announced just recently they're partnering with a pizza maker for food delivery in an autonomous vehicle in Miami, Florida. Any source of concern there for you about that?
No, I think as we look at the space, again, drawing us back to the market for miles, there's 10 trillion miles on our planet. That's going to continue to grow. We see a wonderful opportunity as the world, you know, first step electrifies, but then as we move into these new consumption models to create unique branded experiences under our Rivian brand. But then we also see opportunities to leverage our technology. And as I think we talked a little bit before, there's multiple opportunities to take that technology and use that in other applications as well. So, you know, when you start to look at some of the sort of call it B2B, business to business, or more logistics types operations, these are avenues for some of our battery technology to be applied as well.
Is Rivian in this for the long haul, or is the technology and the company and the things you're developing might make the company look attractive to an outside buyer?
No, we're not. We're not designing the strategy of the business to be bought. So we're designing this to create an incredible set of products and an incredible set of technologies that really get customers excited and provide something that's unique in the marketplace.
Some of those products will be manufactured here in Bloomington Normal. Here's what you said at the end of 2016 regarding the Rivian plant and spinning up for vehicle production.
At the plant side, there's a whole host of planning activities that are going to occur over the next year. So mapping out how this vehicle goes into the plant, what changes need to be made to the facility, what portions of the facility we're able to reuse, what portions of the facility we need to replace. And over the course of the next 2 years, we'll be ramping up with implementing those plans. So replacing equipment, improving certain aspects of the facility.
You've touched on this. What kind of progress are you making at the plant to make sure production starts when you want it to start?
Sure. So I talked a little bit before about some of the hiring we've done at the plant. So we're now up to approximately 40 people at the plant. And what we're doing is we're going through and taking some of the equipment out that's unnecessary for our process, preparing the plant to be, you know, to have new equipment, replacing that older equipment, and then also taking some of the existing equipment and getting it operational. So this is everything from running different portions of the plant to working through cooling systems, working through the control systems. So a plant of this size, and I referenced this before, takes a considerable amount of time to get the whole thing running. It's a very large orchestra of controls, equipment, and machines.
You were enthusiastic about the plant when we talked last because of the sheer amount of room. Will suppliers actually occupy some of the space of the plant?
It's a great question. So we are working actively with a number of different potential partners to come in and operate as in-plant suppliers and in-plant partners to us and for us. We don't have any announcements to make today, but we hope to have some exciting announcements in that over the course of the next year.
And we also talked about battery module and pack assembly. Yeah. What about that? Also planned in-house at the former Mitsubishi plant?
Yeah, so we're building and we've designed an outstanding battery module, battery management system, and pack design. And those will be built here in Normal in the plant.
Have you released the range of those batteries yet? We're talking about an adventure vehicle that's going to go out into the boonies and back. What range are we talking about?
So we have several different battery sizes. Of course, the larger packs being more expensive. But the largest pack, we're looking at over 400 miles in range.
That's Rivian Automotive CEO RJ Scaringe. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. How will people actually purchase a Rivian pickup or an SUV?
So to start, we're setting up a distribution channel that allows us direct access to customers. And with that direct channel, you'd be able to buy it, of course, through online mechanisms, but also by going into one of our retail locations. Now, of course,
so is a retail location the same thing as a dealership?
Except to be a direct model, meaning we would own and operate those retail locations.
And would I buy one off the floor or actually order one? Or unknown at this point?
You'd order one. Those retail locations won't be carrying a lot of inventory by design. And our rollout plan has us launching in a number of markets up and down the West Coast and up and down the East Coast, but eventually moving into a whole host of markets throughout the country and then, of course, globally as well.
Chicago area eventually?
Yeah, for sure.
In 2016, you said you viewed the tax abatement and the benchmarks you had to meet to continue to get those abatements as floors. Mm-hmm. And that you were working to exceed those in terms of investment and employment levels. Is Rivian on target to meet the $10 million 35 employee in, level in 2018? You already mentioned you've exceeded the 35 employees.
On the employment, we've already exceeded the 2018 requirements. And on the investment, we're confident we'll well exceed that.
And again, something else we talked about in late 2016 was the UAW. As you ramp up for production, will the UAW, formerly associated with Mitsubishi, be part of this picture? Or are you just using their workforce? And is there any, have you heard anything about efforts to union?
So we're not engaged in those discussions, and we haven't begun the process of putting together a workforce plan in detail for when we're operating in production.
Okay. RJ Scaringe, CEO of Rivian Automotive, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
Scaringe says both the SUV and pickup have been named, but those names have not been made public. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout Central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Breaking news travels fast, and sometimes it's hard to keep up.
Used a vulgar slur in reference
injured
to
in a school shooting in Western
Open, prompting a shutdown on the NASA will spend at least 40 years in
a week, an Amtrak train has crashed.
An emergency alert that there was an incoming.
Deciphering what it means doesn't have to be difficult. Morning Edition is there to unpack the day's biggest stories and dig into all the details. Listen every day.
Here, Morning Edition, Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The filmmaker behind The Colorado thinks of it as a documentary. The project has some significant differences, though. Two-thirds of the film is a marriage of stunning visuals and original music commissioned from five composers. Filmmaker Murat Eyobolu says there's very little narration by Oscar-nominated Shakespearean actor Mark Rylance, and there are no interviews or talking heads. The New York Times calls it a music-driven eco-documentary. The film surveys the River Basin's history, its cultures, its ecology, the dams, and climate change. Bloomington Normal audiences will have an opportunity to screen the award-winning film and attend a guest lecture by Eyobolu Tuesday, March 6th at Illinois Wesleyan University's Hanson Student Center. The film opens and closes with the human myth of origins.
This is my water. My water. This is my river. My river. We love its water. We love its driftwood. It shall flow forever. When the weather grows hot, it shall rise and overflow its banks. It shall flow forever.
Narrator Mark Rylance and the human myth of origins, which opens and closes the film The Colorado. Filmmaker Murat Eyobolu, why bookend your film with these words?
I think the reason behind that was to give a voice to the indigenous populations that have been there for many millennia. And I looked for traces of oral literature that I could find. And what I was able to find, and I was actually very pleased to find, was a human myth about the Colorado River, and it was transcribed and published in early 20th century and published in a journal in 1908. So that's the reason why I selected that.
And the words are important enough to begin and end the film with?
I think so, because it expresses a very personal connection to the river, and it's also very descriptive of the behavior of the Colorado River, which the water levels varies greatly. even though it's only just a few lines, I feel like it really captures the essence of the river as far as I know the river.
The Yuman is an overarching term for any Native American who traditionally lived in the lower Colorado River Valley, in western Arizona, southern California, northern Baja California. For this area and the Native Americans who still live there, the river does not flow forever, does it?
That's right. Over the past few decades, the river is not reaching the delta unless it's an exceptionally wet year. And there have been just a few of those over the past three or four decades. And the reason for that is the water retention in North America, or in the U.S. rather specifically. You know, by agreement, to get into the details a little bit, 10% of any given year's flow goes to Mexico. And of course, Mexico has its own industries, has its own agriculture and cities for which it uses the water. And the delta is tragically desiccated at the moment.
Yes. What's happened to the Colorado River Delta?
Well, the Colorado River Delta, which was a lush, really lush wetland, and its descriptions from the early 20th century are just really unbelievable. Is just a dry area. I mean, there's just some very small amount of vegetation that really grows in those really salty conditions, like salt cedar thickets and things like that. And as you've seen also in the film, it's visually a really stunning area, but just for all the wrong reasons. And I should also mention that there are efforts to rehabilitate parts of the delta. And that effort is led by both some Mexican NGOs as well as the American NGOs, such as the Sonoran Institute and Pro Natura in Mexico. And I've visited those areas. The moment a small amount of water returns, and if it's well managed, it's unbelievable how quickly the habitat recovers, but it takes a lot of effort, and those areas at the moment are rather small areas.
Yeah, the aerial views of the delta that you've included in your film are stunning. They're very colorful, but it's not vegetation that we're looking at. It's chemical residue and salt and those sorts of things, correct?
Yes, exactly. They often look like abstract paintings and they look very interesting, but actually there's in the area, in the images that we show, there's no vegetation in those areas, and it's largely salt and mineral residues and so on and so forth, as you said.
Murat, what led you to this project? Why a film on the Colorado River?
Well, it was I have to say I stumbled upon it a little bit. I was working on a small project in the Salton Sea area. And I started researching that area, which led me to William Dubuis's book, Salt Dreams, which is a social and ecological history of the lower Colorado River Basin. And I felt like there were many stories to tell about that region, and it was a massive cautionary tale. But I wasn't sure what the larger story was to which the Salton Sea story belonged. So while researching that, and working with William Dubuis, we actually have arrived at the story of the Colorado River as a basin.
And we'll talk a little bit more about the ecological disaster that is the Salton Sea in just a moment. Is this a documentary or is it something else?
I think it's a documentary. I think of it as a documentary, except that it has a large musical component to it. Two-thirds of the film is just pure music. Some of it has lyrics. But those parts that have just music and images are strictly contextual. So I think that's what makes it a unique documentary, I think, in the sense that we do get the documentary content, but then we do get to reflect on that documentary content through an immersion in images and music.
Yeah, there's no talking heads, no interviews, precious little narration. As you said, most of the film is music, the images are accompanied by music. It's been described as a film oratorio. What do you think of that description?
Yes, that phrase is used. I think it's a The descriptive phrase, I personally don't like the use of the word oratorio because it, for me, it connotes a very specific 18th century musical form. And that's, I'm sure, is the music historian in me. I'm a music historian alongside a filmmaker. But I think it captures the sense that it actually a story is told through music and words, and I think that's a fair description for the film.
So music and stunning visuals tell this story. Why take this approach? Why not more a traditional documentary approach?
You know, I think I essentially believe in music, and it's one of my music and images is one of my personal strengths. I think when I look at my own background. I'm originally a trained photographer, and then I studied music history, and I taught at the university level for a number of years. And then I got into filmmaking. So it, in a sense, combines my strengths. And I think that's the best way I can tell a story.
Well, what do you want to say about the composers you chose for this project? And what do you want to say about the music?
I started working with the composers that I had known and I had a working relationship with. And upon discussing with them as to who else should be on the project and so on and so forth, it has been a very organic process of discussing and getting others interested and so on and so forth. But one thing I want to say about the number of composers is that the idea behind that is that The film covers a really broad topic, both geographically and historically. And we didn't want a single musical voice or single character or single voice to dominate that really broad historic time frame. I feel like it worked well, but I let others decide.
Well, let's talk about a specific piece of music, and this particular piece of music accompanies a part of the film about John Wesley Powell, who certainly has a connection to Bloomington Normal. Why was this particular music piece of music important to you?
Well, first of all, the story of John Wesley Powell is entirely central to not only the Colorado River, because he is actually the official explorer of the river and has written a bestseller a number of years after his expedition. But I think I can safely say that the scholarly output and the life and the ideals of John Wesley Powell pretty much stand behind the aspirations of this project, in the sense that he had a holistic vision of the land and the population of the land by people.
Well, let's listen to An Unknown Distance to Run with lyrics by William DuBois. Music from the Colorado. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy talking with filmmaker Murat Eyyubolu. He gives a guest lecture after the screening of his film, The Colorado, tomorrow at Illinois Wesleyan University. IWU and the Colorado share a connection thanks to John Wesley Powell, who was a professor of geology, among other things, at Illinois Wesleyan and a lecturer at Illinois State University. Let's listen to part of the film again. This is narrator Mark Rylance.
For three centuries after Spaniards first entered the region, the central parts of the Colorado watershed remained a blank spot on the map of America, a terra incognita. This changed in 1869, when Major John Wesley Powell, a one-armed veteran of the Civil War, led a crew of nine men in four boats down the Colorado River from Green River Station in the Wyoming Territory through the Grand Canyon to the Mormon settlements near the mouth of the Virgin River in Nevada. A constantly perilous journey of nearly 1,000 miles. Powell's crew consisted of mountain men and Civil War veterans.
We learned so much from John Wesley Powell's expedition. What do you want to say about Powell and his first expedition?
Well, I think of it as a kind of an American odyssey, and him as a kind of like Odysseus, because it really is an incredible journey. Like, imagine going down that stretch, especially the Grand Canyon, with these large wood boats, not knowing at all what's ahead of you, and going through these incredible rapids and so on and so forth. So that journey itself is one of the greatest adventure journeys in the history of North America. But then the narrative he created out of it, and the vision of the American West that he created based on his observations and studies of the American West, I think, is what really creates the legacy of John Wesley Powell.
Sure. Powell had an idea about how to manage the land and the river. Again, here's Mark Rylance from your film, The Colorado.
His life's labors culminated in a holistic vision for the settlement of the West based on what he called watershed commonwealths and a close understanding of the limits of the land. His vision was accurate and prophetic, yet opposition from land speculators and politicians alike ultimately defeated it. Many advocates for the land have looked back on that with regret ever since.
How would these watershed commonwealths have worked?
Well, it would require the West to be settled after it was carefully surveyed, the watershed studied, and then the settlement guided on the basis of those principles and results, the data of the survey.
And of course, settlement occurred more organically than that.
Yes, exactly. So his ideas, even though they would have, I think that the water situation would have been very different if the West had been settled based on the ideas that he had developed. But it kind of flew in the face of people acting independently, and it also conflicted with many real estate interests and so on and so forth. And it was not possible in practical terms to actually apply his principles. In fact, he did lead a survey of watersheds. And I think, and that study, that team that was going around was trailed very closely by real estate speculators and so on and so forth. So it was very hard to apply his ideas.
How do you think the Colorado River Basin would be different today had we followed Powell's plan?
I think there wouldn't have been the need to create these vast reservoirs. And then perhaps the main river wouldn't have been drained so much, because the settlement as well as the agricultural production would have been, instead of concentrating on few large areas that required huge water diversions, they would have been spread across the existing smaller watersheds. So that's what I think would have been the result of his vision.
And we would have avoided maybe some of the ecological disasters like the Salton Sea?
Most likely, yes. Most likely that would have been avoided as well. You know, to note, the idea of irrigation, doing agriculture with irrigation, is actually, as long as there's infinite water supply, is a brilliant idea. And it worked beautifully for 100 years or so, I think. But now it's like, now that the demand on the water is so much more and the supply is less, so it's a story of declining supply and increasing demand, it doesn't seem sustainable anymore.
How much of the history of the Colorado is intertwined with ecological disaster?
Well, I think the Salton Sea is the most emblematic one, I would say. In the film, it has a disproportionately large place. There's a section devoted to the Salton Sea, and then the Imperial Valley, where there's a large agricultural empire.
Where we get most of our winter vegetables.
Exactly. Whether we know it or not, we actually eat produce from there. And then I think the second really emblematic story is the Delta. It really is an unbelievable story how the Delta has been desiccated. You've seen a Kukapa elder towards the end of the film, and she's walking across this really dry desert-like mud flat. Something that's not explained in the film, and I might as well say it right now, is that her name is Inocencia Gonzalez, and she coincidentally happens to be exactly the same age as Hoover Dam. She was born the year that Hoover Dam was finished.
Really?
Yes. So she remembers that very area where she's walking as a wetland, where they used to come fishing and they used to bring their animals to the surrounding hills and so on and so forth. And there she is in her early 80s right now, and walking the same lands. And she was actually talking through that to us. I think I would say that the Delta is definitely the second major ecological disaster that's related to the Colorado River Basin.
Well, Hoover Dam and Lake Mead is what many people think of first in terms of water storage along the Colorado. Yeah. There's an equally impressive dam at Glen Canyon, which created Lake Powell. I want to play a section of your film about Glen Canyon, and we'll talk afterwards.
If Powell's visit to Glen Canyon was the first by non-natives, that of David Brower was one of the last that anyone would make for a very long time. Brower, the executive director of the Sierra Club, had just led the campaign to save Echo Park in Dinosaur National Monument from being flooded by a dam. He and his allies had proposed Glen Canyon as an alternate location, but none of them knew what they were giving up. None of them had seen it. When Brower finally came to Glen Canyon, he realized that sacrificing it was the biggest mistake of his life.
The narrator goes on to say, many people don't think of Glen Canyon Dam for the water it stores, but for the treasures it drowned. What did we lose by drowning Glen Canyon?
Well, when Glen Canyon was decided to be the location of Glen Canyon Dam, the area was very little known. It hadn't been traveled much since the expedition of John Wesley Powell. And in fact, if you look at John Wesley Powell's book, he does talk about ruins, settlements, and even like pottery just lying around on the surface of the soil and so on and so forth. Now, the dam idea was moved to Glen Canyon because Sierra Club actually had fought the idea of a dam at the Dinosaur National Monument at Echo Park. So that was a successful campaign, and the public did not want a major dam at the Utah-Colorado border at the Echo Park. So an alternative had to be found, and the alternative was the unknown area of Glen Canyon. So when people came to know what they were going to lose at Glen Canyon, that came as a shock, and actually it could no longer be fought. And so then there were all these archaeological expeditions and studies that were done in a really narrow time frame because the dam construction was underway. And I think we cite a figure there. There were over 2,000 sites that were marked and studied by archaeologists, and of course not fully excavated because of the time frame that was due. And so, in a sense, we don't know what we lost. And so there's a significant human heritage there we will not know about for a very long time. Maybe the dam will be removed one day, and then the area will become accessible again. And that's a possibility because the water levels are so low in these giant reservoirs right now that they can be combined technically.
So what's the balance sheet look like in terms of the benefits of water storage and agriculture you know, juxtaposed with the loss of environment and impact on cultures. What did society lose and gain as a result of damming the Colorado, and are we ahead?
Mm-hmm. Well, these are really large questions.
Those are the questions your film led me to.
That's right. Well, yes. I think what's interesting is how land is perceived. It's perceived as something that can be shaped into a particular human vision. And if you look at it from that angle, that vision actually is realized. And I think there's some point in the movie where it talks about how all the predictable unpredictabilities of the river had been overcome because these two large reservoirs had created these massive bank accounts, so that if there actually was a deficit one year, it would balance it. And in fact, if you take a tour of Grand Canyon Dam, that's precisely how they explain it to you. It's like a bank account. If there's a drought, even if it's for several years, there's that huge water source that actually takes you through those dry years and so on. But I think that perhaps, like the vision that John Wesley Powell developed, there could have been a vision where settlement is more in tune with the limits of the land. And in fact, that's a term that John Wesley Powell used, and a point that he emphasized very much. What are the limits of the land, and how can social settlement be realized by being cognizant of those limits?
Has that ever happened anywhere in the history of human development, though?
Well, I think that really the break happens when we come into the industrial era, because you know native settlements have been there for about 12,000 years,
and they were living within their means.
They were living within their means, and they were farming with floodwaters. They had irrigation ditches that to divert water, but with those means, you probably couldn't have an agricultural empire like the Imperial Valley, for instance. You could sustain your own community. You could farm for yourself. So it's like you could do. You couldn't do cash crops, but you could sustain yourself. So it's a very different idea of society, and how to respond to the needs of the industrial era with the kind of population growth that we are seeing there in the large towns. How to reconcile that with the limits of the land is the ultimate question, I think, of today. Because at this point, it no longer is sustainable, the current demand and the supply.
And the world and the American West is facing climate change. How does that affect the future of the West and the overused and overpromised Colorado, which is language from the film?
That's right. Well, the climate change predictions is that so the Southwest is going to be hotter and drier, and which means that it actually is going to need more water. And most of the Colorado River water comes from the snowmelt from the Rocky Mountains, and there's actually less of that. So in a sense, the cities there, for instance, like Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tucson, and so on and so forth, have already been experiencing the consequences of climate change for a while, and they are developing certain solutions. They are trying to deal with it, and I think they will be kind of exemplary cases from which other parts of the world even are going to learn how to deal with the new realities of a drier world.
In fact, you have a sort of snarky line in your film that says there's going to be a lot more desert, and the people who live along the Colorado since they're used to it, will like that, right?
You know, yes, that's right.
You mean your joke? It's sort of a joke, but a dark joke.
It's a dark joke. Yeah. Exactly. There's going to be more desert. But people of the Colorado, they already love the desert because it's actually the Colorado River runs through the desert.
Right. Well, Murat, thanks for your time. We appreciate your time to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Filmmaker Murat Iyubolu via Skype. He'll screen his film, The Colorado, and present a guest lecture Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. at IWU's Hanson Student Center. Following the success of The Colorado, Iyubolu says his next project will examine the Amazon River Basin. Here's more from the film and narrator Mark Rylance.
Nothing stays the same forever. Death always takes its toll. And climate change, whether within the candle flame span of a human life or the stony eternities of the great canyons, will accelerate the pace of transformation. The people of the Colorado, however, start with an advantage. They already love the desert. That's good. There's going to be a lot more of it.
An excerpt of the film, The Colorado, showing Tuesday, March 6th at Illinois Wesleyan University's Hanson Student Center. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the stories and interviews you hear on Sound Ideas by visiting WGLT.org. Subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast at our website or at iTunes. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.